from Scuola Normale Superiore, Florence. Her lecture is titled Deconstructing Generations in Movement, Evidences from Anti-Austerity Protest in Europe. So welcome to all of you. This is a core event, and this core event is belongs to the series of our core project, Civic Action and Collaborative Governance is the number three core event we have here today, and it explores the civic action and collaborative governance in the context of environmental and social movements. With the help of Professor De La Porta, we analyze what leads young people to engage in initiatives in times of more or less severe crises. How do the motivations and forms of engagement of millennials differ from those of previous generations? What do the changing of civil society mean for collaborative governance? We are pleased and honored to have this distinguished Professor De La Porta as our visiting lecturer today because of many reasons. First of all, she's part of our core project as she belongs to the International Advisory Board of our project. In addition to this, she is one of the leading scholars in the field of social movement and civil society research. In our project, we have a work package 3, which focus on the role of civil society and active citizenship in collaborative planning and decision-making processes. Also on collaborative governance methods and capacities required to engage civil society actors widely, effectively, and fairly. The role of civil society organization and the informal fourth sector and e-democracy is also in the focus of our work package. And special attention will be paid and is paid to the engagement capacity holding of currently marginalized groups and potentials arising from the citizen bottom-up initiatives. Therefore, De La Porta's lecture will contribute to our research also. Important is also to mention that De La Porta has cooperated a long time with our university and our department. Latest achievement of De La Porta and our people is a book, De La Porta, Professor Tiina Silvasti, Professor Martti Siisiäinen, sitting here also in the audience, and then Research Professor Sakari Hänninen. They edited in 2015. It was a book called A New Division, New Social Division, Making and Unmaking Precariousness. So I remember very well when you were there in Prague in 2015 in ESA conference, European Sociological Association conference, and there was this workshop, Author Meets Critics. And then there was this chair session, Eduardo Romanos, and he introduced you as a professor who published more than we all others are able to read. So that is exactly how it is. So can you imagine De La Porta? She has written and edited 90 books. So not 19, but 90 books. And then 135 articles, and then also 130 different kinds of texts in edited volumes. So you have published a lot and contributed to the social science and political science a lot. So because of her outstanding contributions to political science and sociology, De La Porta will be conferred as the University of Jyväskylä's honorary doctor in the conferment of degrees ceremony on tomorrow, Saturday, 25th of May in 2019. I mean today, tomorrow, yeah. And before I give the floor to you and I will say that we have, in the end of the lecture, we have a commentary speech from Maya Fainle. You haven't said that it wasn't there.
I had a suspect, but I thought maybe new technology.
It's there in the video, but not there. So let me see if I at least can show you the picture of Maya Fainle. Maya is over there. Now it's...
Yes.
And because of my clumsiness in this, I will show you quickly the other slides I should have shown to you. Here is my picture of our professor, distinguished scholar. Here is a picture of our core project. And then the beginning slide. So we are here. In the end, you will have a sort of commentary by Maya Fainle. But this is enough for me before I ruin the whole lecture. Okay, the floor is
Thank
yours,
you.
And then I change the...
Thank you. Thank you, Tapio, very much. In fact, it is true. I've been a friend of Juvascular University for, we were discussing with Marty, about 30 years. And I've seen Juvascular in many different moments and many different seasons. And I'm very honored to be now here to give this presentation and to be awarded the honorary doctorate. When we were discussing with Tapio what could be of interest for the project, I suggested to present some results from a research project which is ongoing at the Cosmos Center, the Center on Social Movement Studies of the Scuola Normale Superiore, and in which we addressed young people mobilizations from the empirical point of view, so people, young people mobilizing against austerities for environment. We were also lucky to be able to follow and do research upon the Fridays for Future recent protest, and from the empirical point of view to cover millennials, what we called millennials generations, mobilizations by them in Italy, Poland, Spain, and the UK. As a beginning, we plan to expand this. But especially from the theoretical point of view, what we wanted to contribute to is in research on social movement studies, attention to what generations means. So there have been several observations I'm going to address that tells us that young people are very important for social movements. They've always been those who have mobilized most in different forms. And we also know that cohorts and generations play a role with their different type of cultural taste, experiences of mobilizations in the forms that social movements take. But the research on young people has been growing quite apart from research on social movements. So when we started this research, we went to look at the studies of generations, the studies of political participations by young people. We found a lot of interesting things, but the bridge between social movement studies and research on young people, cohort, and generations was, we thought, still to be developed. And so one of the theoretical ideas is to bridge social movement studies and generational studies, but to do it in a specific moment. And this is where I will start my presentation. What does it mean to study generations and young people mobilizations nowadays? Which type of characteristics the relationship between the market and the state has? Which are the forms of capitalism that young people resist against or address? And which type of broad transformations in the political, social, and cultural systems they have to face. Then I will present some specific evidences of social movement studies that address the issues of young people, of cohorts, and of generations. And then I will go into some evidences from our research telling us how these generations perceive itself and which are the forms of organizations, actions, and framing that the mobilizations by millennials take. Just a caveat, we have been investigating what we consider to be progressive movements, but of course the type of context that I'm going to talk about is the same in which also regressive movements tended to develop, and so it would be a next step of the research to try to see how within similar context different types of movements developed, also among young people, let's say, on the left and on the right. So this is the very broad frame within which we located our research, which is the frame that I had developed also in a previous book, Social Movements in Times of Austerity. And I think that I had also presented something coming from that book here in Juvascola on another occasion. And the attempt was in this book especially to bring capitalism back in, bring classes back in, bring type of structural conflicts back in the pictures of social movement studies that had tended to develop focusing more on new social movements that were considered as sort of classless, if not social movements of the middle classes. And in fact, the book we wrote with Marty and the other colleagues was oriented to look specifically at one of these classes, the precariat, and how precarity was affecting social movements in different forms. So what I want to address is millennials, mobilizations not in abstract terms, but contextualized within what I considered as characteristics of our time. Late neoliberalism, that is the specific characteristics of the interactions between state and the market, in a situation characterized by the strong emphasis on the market against the social protections. In Karl Polanyi's terms, liberalism could be seen as part of the swing of capitalism between the stress on social protections in more ethical forms of capitalism and the strength instead on free market in the more unconstrained forms of capitalism. And what I mean with late neoliberalism is neoliberalism in its crisis. So in a moment in which since 2008, more or less, neoliberalism was no longer rampant, no longer promising the progress and evolutions, entered into a long crisis. As Colin Crouch has reflected upon the long and strange non-death of neoliberalism meant we are still living in under forms of interactions between the state and the market, which has been for long in crisis, so more than 10 years of evidence of this crisis, but still not substituted by what in the past was the New Deal that had corrected the path of the first great transformations in Polanyi's terms. And I think that late neoliberalism is also related with the crisis of responsibility of the institutions. So I'm going to quickly say neoliberalism didn't develop out of just technological change, but it developed out of choices by authorities, governments, and so on, to give up parts of their capacity to implement citizenship rights and to renounce in this way to be responsible towards their citizens. Increasing inequality and precarity with the weakening of traditional forms of identities have been considered as typical characteristics of this time, which have been even further strengthened by the late neoliberalism and the political crisis, as I'm going to say, embedding it in the research on the young people. And the effect, so on the last part of the pictures, on social movements have been not in terms of the mobilizations, but in terms very often of development of a strong wave of protest, characterized as a mobilization of those most affected by the late neoliberalism, that is, the crisis of neoliberalism, by subjects that undergo strong attempt to build new identities. So what Laclau called populist reasons, the need to resignify and empty signifiers like the people, and a strong emphasis on a moral discourse against the immorality of capitalism that Karl Polanyi had already pointed at in the past as a characteristic of the counter-movements against liberal churn in capitalism. And finally, a movement characterized by a very horizontal, karsic, fluid form of organizations with a lot of emphasis, like in the movements of the squares in Southern Europe, on the prefigurations of alternatives. And in Finland, there have been also experiences of the ways in which these movements, the Occupy movements, the Indignados movement, has developed with a strong capacity to involve young people. So summarizing what I said until now, I think late neoliberalism is characterized by a sort of second great transformations with the dominance of free market. But late neoliberalism is also the crisis of liberalism with the strange non-disappearance of a form of interactions between the state and the market that has been in crisis for long, and specifically with critical junctures that have assumed different characteristics in different geographical areas, increasing rather than decreasing the differences between European countries. So one of the book we wrote with colleagues in Florence is on how the crisis differently affected even the European peripheries that have hit the most. And the political dimensions of the crisis, I think, can be connected with what Jürgen Habermas used to call a crisis of legitimacy, that is the spillover of a crisis in the socioeconomic system on the political system. While Habermas was talking in the 70s about the ways in which the welfare state was sort of assuming responsibility for the inequalities in the market, the crisis of responsibilities, or what I call the crisis of responsibilities, is pointing at another interactions between the market and the state, the economic and the political, in which there is rather de-responsabilizations through loss of institutional power. Deregulations, liberalizations, privatizations as the main trend in the interactions between state and the market, all meant by the very name, the giving up of capacities by the states of instruments that they had to control the market and reduce inequalities. At the cultural level, this is, for instance, articulated by Chantal Mouffe in a recent reflections on populism as a response to the depolitizations which was typical of neoliberalism. So considering government just as a technical issues and disclaiming politics as capacity to elaborate solution. It was the type of development of financial capitalism, of what political economists called private Keynesianism, that tried to keep aggregate demand up through the debt, indebting also of private people and sovereignty loss. So this is the context. How can we address young people within this type of context? In the sociology of political participations, there are some important concepts like cohort, statistically aggregated around years of birth, so group of people that were born in the same people. In the same period, there are the youth as a sort of demographic concept, people born within the usually 16, 20 years, last 20 years, and so on. But also, the most important concept is generation, which is a more sociological concept, which looks at cohorts which are characterized by some relevant critical junctures during the youth years, so during the periods in which socializations happens, also in politics, and so that, say, in which people apprend styles of doing politics, there are then long-lasting resilience in their life. And in fact, in social movement studies, some attentions went to the generations of 68ers that was considered to be as the generations that kept alive, also when aging, ideas of alternative politics and so on. Last year was the 50th anniversary of 68ers, and there were still debate and celebrations about these generations. And one of the issues that social movement studies have failed to address is how different generations then reemerged and how these specific generations is representing a new turning point in the mobilizations. In fact, there has been some implementations of these general ideas in research on social movements. Jack Goldstone has looked at the demographic characteristics of generations, so the fact that a large youth cohort often have a specific type of political effects. When talking about the Arab Spring, for instance, One of the issues that has been pointed at is the presence of a very large cohort of young people that present specific challenges. Of course, this is very different in the north and in the west, where it is rather the lack of this cohort which is having a significant impact on the development of societies. But the main point is to see how the general balance between generations has an effect. There are psychological type of approaches. Olivier Filliol talked about the Pampers syndrome, so the tendency to consider the young as characterized by very specific psychological characteristics, the push towards rebellious characteristics, the generosity, if you want to see it from the positive point of view, of some adventurous characteristics. Political socializations has been studied also within movements. A book some time ago was called The Persistent Activist, showing how even in times of doldrums, in times of low mobilizations, those who have been socialized within social movements tend to keep alive in different forms their social type of commitments. And some research has been done also on how the specific characteristics of movements from the point of view of which generations are involved has an effect on the ways in which people mobilize. So typically, the social justice movement was considered as a multi-generational movement in which several different generations developed. We did some research on it, and we had from the generations of the resistance to fascism to the generations of the very young people, activists of very different backgrounds. But some movements are instead tend to be more mono-generational, remaining enclosed, constrained by the first generations that mobilized. So research has been looking at the characteristic of the generations, but also of the young cohorts, psychological characteristics that I mentioned, enthusiasm, idealism, exposure to new ideas. More important in social movement studies, what McAdam called the biographical availability of young people, given limited responsibilities, availability of time, and so on. Research on the student movement that we have also been looking at in a comparative research project in Florence pointed at the importance of the type of dense networks that can be formed within universities. Nick Crosley is one of the authors who has addressed this. And the cultural typical characteristics that, for instance, Engelhardt has defined as post-materialistic type of ethics. Whatever is the type of interpretation, what often emerges is that young people do represent large group within the mobilizations and within social movements. This is a table from a survey that we did at the first European Social Forum in Florence, and people between up to 18 plus 19 to 25 represented, if we looked at the task is the Tuscan participant in them, so 26.3, 34.8, about 60% of those who participated in this demonstration. So they are largely present. They are presented, though, in different percentage in different generations. We also did surveys in several demonstrations And what we noted is that on issues like austerities, social struggles, and so on, you have very different percentage of participation of people. So protests could also remain very balkanized, pillarized on generational issues, with traditional protest like the May Day, characterized by 90% of people of older generations, and in comparison, protest like the Euro May Day instead, that was the protest of the young precarious people, characterized by the opposite type of percentage, 80%. Of young people versus just 20% of old people. But this just to make some, give some illustrations. Also, if we look at the ways in which European social forums developed, we see that with the institutionalizations of the process from 2002 to 2006, the percentage of young people declined, and there was a growth instead of older generations. And this went together with a sort of reduction, shrinking of the social basis for this type of events like the European social forums, and so the less innovative and creative characters. Another ways of looking at the importance of political socializations for social movements is in looking at the ways in which social movements developed and the type of generational groups that become more relevant. This is a table from a research I've done with Lorenzo Bosi on radical movements that developed into violent forms. And what we saw is that with some consistency from the Italian Red Brigades to the German Rote Armee Fraktion, but also the Irish or the Basque groups, there was a significant difference in the type of networks that sort of led the mobilizations. In the beginning, there were people socialized within the core of the subculture, let's say, coming from left-wing families or very strong ethno-nationalist families. Then there was a second generation of more political groups. And eventually, there were groups of young people that were directly socialized into the violence that had been spreading. So all these characteristics played a role in the ways in which political conflicts escalated. So we had this in mind, this framework in mind, when we started our research, and the research was oriented towards interviewing representatives of different groups of young people that were active in different areas. So we looked at young people within the student movements, within the labor movements, within environmental movements, and within sort of countercultural groups that were active, especially on music, but also sports, trying to provide alternative spaces for the young people. And the first questions that we asked to these people was about how did they conceive themselves. So, what is this a generation of? And we found consistency with some specifications between the countries and the groups, but the first term that was used was always precarity, so like in the book that we had addressed. Their perceptions by young people that they were growing up facing very strong, very specific type of challenges. stagnant wages, highly challenging housing conditions, increasing inequality, deteriorations of public services and public institutions, mental health problems that were also often mentioned in our research, causalizations and destabilizations of labor, and much more. So the lack of a secure employment, not only in the present, but also as a perspective for a long period, what was these activists told us characterized their life, so that precarity was an identity which was not claiming for with pride, but which was considered as very pregnant of consequences for their own life. And in fact, this was a research done before the movement of Fridays for Future, but it was interesting that future was one of the terms which was very much used during the interviews to stress the fact that as a generation, they perceive themselves as a no future generation, as a generation in which, one activist said, the future we took for granted would not be there. The future that the generations of their parents took for granted would not be there. And what they pointed at was that it was not just the precarity of the material conditions that was important, but also the type of existential precarity that this brought about. Subtractions of free time, commodifications of the time. And in fact, these conditions was the one that was resisted through the creations of alternative spaces that I will tell you about later on. So a precarious generation, a generation also from the cultural point of view, in conditions of not being able to foresee a future. And what we had not expected but emerged very strongly was also a threatened generation. So a generation that from the political point of view felt as most stigmatized, not only not represented, but also often considered to be part of the problems. Many activists told us we are fed up with being considered the problems. We could be the solution. But in different ways, all the trends towards illiberal forms of democracy, towards restrictions of citizens' rights, was perceived by these generations as targeting especially the youth. This was especially strong in the UK, where anti-terrorist type of laws were seen by especially young people of color as symbolizing the connections between young people and the threat of say plurality, the threat of the terrorism, the threat of something coming from the outside. And the youth also in view of the type of preventive measures that went along with anti-terrorist type of legislations perceived themselves as a particular target of these actions of repression by the states. And also they perceived themselves as an orphaned generation. So they talked of a trauma of defeat, and this is a quote from an Italian activist, but this could be generalized. He said, "We lived a drama of being orphaned of a left that betrayed our generations and that at a certain point did not exist for us as a point of reference anymore." So repression by the states, but also the feeling that no one in the political system, not even the left that should have defended against social inequalities and generational inequalities as part of it, was able to or willing to address and to represent. So this sense that it is not that the young people do not like politics or are apathetic, but that the politics as institutional politics has given them no choice of participating in the state activities. And that this is not just the feelings of part of these generations, but it is, as one of another activist stressed, a common thread for all generations. Okay, so these are the characteristics that's our self-representation of the young people. Nevertheless, what we saw was that it doesn't bring about apathy. It brings about a lot of challenges to mobilizations, even in the universities, because precarity and commodifications of educations often means that there is much less time to devote to political forms of participations or social movements, but that nevertheless there are forms of protest which take specific characteristics. So vis-a-vis that's the general characteristics of social movements in times of late neoliberalism that I had synthesized in the first slide, young activism presents some specific characteristics that I'm trying to synthesize by looking at the typical toolkit of social movement studies, looking at organizational formats, repertoires of actions and at the framing. So in terms of organizational repertoires, one activist says our activism is very transient, very fluid, very, time-related. We mobilize on causes, one of them said. And it is though also a very fast form of mobilizations. One of the young activists says there is a tendency that I also have, which is of a total impatience, lack of patience. I can't read something that is longer than a tweet. I find it hard to read things that are too long. With older activists, you'd have meetings that last 4, 5, 6 hours. I was being like, what? 6 hours? That's a certain style. I don't think younger activists are able to engage at that level. So one of the issues that emerged very clearly from the interviews was the organizations that are thought and prepared by adults, by older people, do not adapt to our kind of general cultures. Even organizations that are thought to be for the youth, like the youth organizations of political parties, reflect old modes of activism that are not attractive for young people. To the opposite, they are repulsive to them. And so this type of impatience is, of course, a challenge, but it is a challenge that some of the groups we have analyzed try to meet by adapting forms of organizing to the taste of the younger group. In terms of activities, in fact, what we saw is that yes, young people do participate a lot in protests, and Fridays for Future is just the last example of this, but also that what they want to do as political forms of actions is very often oriented more towards prefigurations of potential alternatives. So they don't want to meet and talk a lot, but to create spaces. And they give a rationale for this. They say when you don't have free times because you have to run from your university lectures to a small job to get enough money to pay for your fees and then to be able to continue this very intense type of life. You don't want are not available to other forms of boring activism. What you need to do is to propose things that are per se rewarding, that can be embedded in a sort of immediate reconquering the type of spaces that neoliberalism has commodified and taken away from the young themselves. So spaces, creating spaces, and a British activist said, for people to exist within as opposed to a space for people to be outwards, about having internal conversations. And in fact, a very successful forms of mobilizations that we saw was the creations of alternative space where to be active in sports or in countercultural events, but perceived not just as these type of activities, but as the politicizations of this type of activities by the very actions of performing them within a commodified space. And what's young people stress in terms of framing is the attempt to transform marginalized histories into life, joy, and resistance. In social movement studies, there has been reflections about how to build up positive forms of identifications in identities that had been previously stigmatized. Black is beautiful is one slogan that is often presented as ways to claim as a positive identity, an identity which has been stigmatized before. Women's identities also undergo this type of characteristic, or gay, lesbians, and so on. All examples of people mobilizing for the rights of their own groups that have been excluded, and having, first of all, to do a lot of what Antonio Gramsci called counter-hegemonic work in order to transform stigmatized identities into positive ones. And this is a task that the youth think they have to address because they, when we did research upon, had the impressions that the societies didn't acknowledge them, or that when they acknowledged them, it was just rhetorically so, but not in order to give them real recognitions. So these are some main characteristics. It's what we saw is that they also made for some tensions within social movements. Because we saw in movements recently mobilized, like a sort of third way of women activists, that indeed this type of taste, models of mobilizations by young people tended sometimes to be difficult to communicate to older generations, tended to consider these forms as either too countercultural or too apolitical or too much oriented to fun and less responsible in the long terms. In fact, what we saw in these movements, and now also in the environmental protests that were triggered by the Fridays for Futures type of movements, is that in terms of repertoires of actions, of organizational structures, and of framing, there is some sort of internal clash between different views represented by different generations. So in synthesis, what a Spanish female activist of the women movement says, we want más calle y menos despachos, more streets and less debate, is a message that was given to us by many activists. So we are impatient, we don't want long meetings, but we want actions that could be actions in the street or the actions of producing alternative spaces. We want to live together, we want communal livings, we want to create camps. And all of this is a way to react to the type of characteristics that I've defined previously as fragmenting, disintegrating forms of capitalism that take away the strong identities of the past. What Sigmund Bauman defined as the trading of security for freedom, and that he saw as bringing about liquid societies in a process that was further, say, increased by the crisis of neoliberalism. In terms of visions, we found several tensions within movements, remaining with the examples of the women's movements, the characteristics of the movements of the 70s and the 80s, and so also of the older generations, where, for instance, development of separate movements in which, on the one hand, you had women-only forms of organizations, on the other, women-only form of marches. The terms which can be used to symbolize and synthesizing the message from our research in terms of type of identity work, to cite Laclau, that needs to be done is the terms of queering as attempt to create some sort of bridging between different identities. Also intersectionality, which is a term more and more used, is against the fragmentations of old new social movement identities, the environmentalist, the pacifist, the women's group, and so on. And queering means attempt not just to add this identity one to the others, but to create alternative visions. These tensions have been recognized, but also what I would like to point at is that there is the perceptions within these movements that generational diversities can enrich the protest themselves. That is, that there are rebellious generations that meet within these movements. And I will read this quote and contextualize it. This doesn't come from the research I've been mentioning until now, but comes from another project I developed last year when I was asked to write, edit a collection on the anniversary of 1968. It was, as I mentioned, the 50th anniversary, so it meant that it had been commemorated 10 years after, 20 years after, 30 years after, 40 years after, and that a lot had been written about the 68 as a past movement. When I started to look at the ways in which it could make sense to remember 68, movement of the past, but as a movement that could have had an impact on nowadays movements, so on the anti-protest movements and the millennials generations. And these ideas also came from some strange observations that just by reading newspapers could emerge. For instance, the fact that the leaders of new wave of mobilizations on the left in countries as important as the UK or the United States were old 68ers. So Sanders or Corbyn do not belong to the millennials generations at all, to the opposite, they're even older than me. They belong to the very first moment of the 68 mobilizations, or the mobilizations of what has been called the long 60s. The peculiar thing is that they were supported also by a very young type of generation. So first, the prompt in the directions of looking at how this distant generations, because in some cases it was not even the generations of the parents, it was the generations of the grandparents. How did they communicate? How did they saw each other, considering that there was this strange phenomenon of support of very young people, the pro-Sanders campaigners in the United States, for very old peoples. And this is interesting. A few days ago, there was the cover of the Spiegel, I think it was. It was one of the German newspapers which presented in this type of pictures that was used in the past for the heroes of the communist revolution, Marx, Lenin, Mao Zedong, Stalin, Mao Zedong. It was a similar pictures with Sanders, Corbyn, and Kevin Kühnert, who is the leader of the users, the young organizations of the SPD in Germany, that has had the courage to talk of socialism in Germany. So the picture also there was two old 68ers or even older, and a young millennials, a very young activist, presented as the potential alternative of the on the left, those who reintroduced terms like socialism in the old left even, or in the old center left, or in the old center left that had become neoliberalized. And in this book on 68, which was called, in fact, as subtitle, 1968 in 2018, what I tried to look at with the help of colleagues was how the 68 events played a role nowadays. And it was done by looking not only at the classic countries that have been analyzed, like Germany, France, or Italy, when looking at 68, but looking also at Eastern Europe or Latin America, and trying to see to which extent this memory of a movement which was perceived as a turning point play a role nowadays. So it was looking at generations through the lenses of memories. But for the Italian version of the book, I also added to chapters written by scholars interviews to activists of old or young generations, interviews run by scholars to representatives of this new turn on the left. And one interview was made by Pedro Ibarra to Pablo Iglesias, which represented themselves two different generations, with Pedro Ibarra, a sociologist who had been active during the Franco's Spain, and Pablo Iglesias as a young leader of a new left-wing formations like Podemos. I had an interview with Costa Douzinas, who is a member of parliament in Greece for Syriza, an interview done by a young precarious sociologist. And then there was this two interviews by Hilary Wainwright, who is a journalist of Red Pepper. And she interviewed an old 68ers, who is John Trickett, the Minister of Relationship with the Parliament in the shadow government of Corbyn in the UK. Same generations as Corbyn, so 68 generations on the one hand, and the activist of Momentum, that was a group which was formed among young students who had experienced the student movements in recent years and who mobilized to support Corbyn within the Labour in his campaign to become the leader of the parties. And I found these interviews very interesting because I found in them a sort of recognitions between the two age-wise very different generations. So John Trickett said, what you have now is a generation, it feels to me, that has got the optimism that we had in the 60s. There aren't so many left of us left, probably from my generations. I never lost my sense that things can change for the better. I always believed in it. I always felt it was possible. You had to create the circumstances, though, not wait for them. I spoke earlier about social humanism, and I somehow fused that in my mind with the existentialist ideas that you have to act to make a change. It seems to me that all of that has been imbued in this new generation. So a recognition of the past, 68, in the present. And I think there probably is something we can learn from each other to build the future. So it is an interesting moment. There is a generation ready. It feels to me like those younger than about 30 have huge optimism. In the middle age range of political activism, there is pessimism. So what he found in the new generations was a sort of return of the optimism of being able to perceive and to produce change through action. And this instead is the interviews with two young people of this Momentum group, so the young generations, that's tended to mirror this statement. And the young activist said, I think rather than the thing that was often portrayed in the media, 68 sparked the 2015 moment more than any other area before it. So the 2015 moment is a moment of strong mobilizations and quite radical in terms of framing the struggle. Of course, all different eras influence things in different ways, but I think the sense of a break from the status quo, a sense of reimagining the future and the sense of individuals being empowered to shape their own life. Not that I know loads about the 68 moment, but these things were sparked there. So it's a sort of reciprocal recognitions of two generations on the basis of the perceptions of a potential turning point, of a moment, which is also a term that is repeated, a momentous time. So I think, Tapio, it's time to conclude, right? I think some elements from the research are interesting. One is in terms of who the actors are, and the other is in terms of the characteristics of the precarious mobilization. So self-definitions, identities, and the issues that another sociologist who got the honorary doctorate here in Juvaskala, Alain Touraine, has pointed at a lot is what is the how collective identities are formed. What is this type of generations? And as I mentioned, precarity is a term which is often used, and it means the convergence of different things in different systems, or at different levels. It's economic instability, but it is also the challenge of social fragmentations. It is the challenge of being alone, which is another thing that emerged often in our interviews. We want to create space for us, because otherwise this is a generation that is connected through social media but doesn't find the spaces to connect also beyond the online life. And politically, it is a generation that feels repressed by the political system and betrayed by the organizations, including trade unions and left-wing political parties, that in the past had done a lot in order to integrate, socialize politically new groups. This could bring about apathy, and in fact, of course, there is among young people also components of groups that are totally discouraged from political forms of participations in the ways in which they are proposed to them. But also what we found is that as in the other movements of other generations that I described before, mobilizations goes on with specific type of characteristics that to a certain extent radicalized those characteristics that I described in the first slide. From the organizational level, the term transient that I cited from one interview is quite relevant to describe the organizational forms that young people groups take. So they are ad hoc, they tend to focus on specific needs. They tend to develop very quickly, like Fridays for Future, through the use of new technologies, but also often to have a short life. One of the activists we interviewed said, "I don't belong to any organizations. I mobilize on specific causes. I move from one cause to the others. I tend to leave the challenge of resilience." So say it is easy to mobilize, but it is very difficult to keep mobilizations going. And the forms of countercultural mobilizations are also way to address these very quick ups and downs in the moment of mobilizations in the street. In terms of forms of actions, immediate performances, which is another concept that I took from the interviews themselves, I think reflect well the specific characteristics that we see in different movements, and in particular, if you want to focus attention now on in the Fridays for Future movement. So it is creativity, the presence of specific generations of young people is visible in marches, for instance. In Italy, there was on the 15th of April, a very successful contestations of the so-called anti-gender movement by a new wave of women's movement that mobilized to defend their rights, but also to propose new rights. And they did it with a lot of creativity, with a choreography of the protest that was very different from the ones used by previous type of generations. And this creativity, I think, is also at the same time an asset and a challenge, because creativity means always needing to invent some new things and always needing to integrate, to convince new generations with taste developing and moving very quickly from one to the others. And finally, an asset and a challenge is this quite tolerant type of attitudes by generations that has been testified for also by opinion polls on the entire population. So the millennials tend to be progressive in terms of civic values, in terms of tolerance for diversity, pluralism, and so on. The challenge is to invent and to develop this intersectional framing that is often claimed for, because fragmentations is there and is perceived as hitting people in different forms, and among the young people, the women, and among the young people, the migrants are, of course, even more challenged. And in a situations of scarcity, the tendency towards internal competitions for survival is very strong. So as for our precarious groups, the idea of young people of the world unite is easy to say but difficult to implement, and it requires also a long-lasting constructions of alternative type of identities in times of challenges. So this is the very final slide. If we want to reconstruct the trend from the so-called old progressive movements to nowadays progressive movements in which young people are involved, going through the so-called new movements, new social movements that social movement scholars discussed in the past. We see for sure differences, but we see also for sure common challenges. So social class, social basis, the definitions is again hinting at a class dimension. It's very much stressing the role in a precarious, deregulated labor market. But the precariat that Guy Standing defines is not yet a constituted class. And in fact, the challenge comes also from what Steinrocken defined the normative dimensions, the identity dimensions of a cleavages. Class identities need to be constructed. It needed to be constructed in the past for the working class, and it still need to be constructed nowadays. So the idea that mobility is thwarted by diversity is not really convincing, because also for the working class, there were at the beginning a lot of diversities, internal competitions, and so on, that were especially recomposed, addressed in actions. I found that rereading E.P. Thompson on how the working class made itself as much as it was made is an interesting reading, because it resonate with the challenge for nowadays social movements, which is not to act on already existing political identity, but constructing new identities. And actions, I think, is important. But actions is also the challenge for these generations, for what I meant is a generations for which direct forms of actions are praised, participation is needed against delegations, is a generations which is at the same time radical but also pragmatic, and we see it also in the Fridays for Future, looking for alliances and allowing for the stratifications, for the integrations of different forms of knowledge. But I think also there it is a work in progress, and it is a work on which different generations can contribute. Thank you very much. And I look forward to the comments.
Okay, thank you for such an interesting and inspiring lecture also. And I believe that we have plenty of comments and questions from the audience, so please feel free to ask here.
Thank you very much. It was a rich presentation. I wondered what kind of class concept are you adapting? And at the end of your speech, you mentioned E.P. Thompson's book. Before that already, I thought that perhaps there are more analogical features in 1868 than 1968 and the present situation. I don't know if you have read Garrett Stedman Jones' book, Languages of Class, which deals with the same period than E.P. Thompson's book, and where he says that in early 19th century there was no working class. Mm-hmm. There were different kinds of groups working and being exploited and repressed and so on, like the precariat in one way, and the formation of working class was a discourse of discourses, which included class struggles, literature, culture, associations, movements, and books. So I think that's very good analogy. And for instance, Donatella della Porta's books could be parts of the formation of new. you have written. Okay, but that was my comment.
Thank you. Do you want me to address? It's very interesting comments, Martin. In fact, I think that in a lot of literature which is emerging on the labor movement, which is the literature on which class is more used, there is a reflection on how nowadays time could be similar to the 48 or the times of the first primitive exploitation in Marxist terms. And the times in which the class was formed, in which there were forms of exploitations that have been revisited nowadays by scholars like Harvey or Beverly Silver, talking about Polanyi's type of mobilizations of defending old moral economy. But also a type of mobilizations against extreme forms of exploitations. And what we are studying in Florence now are mobilizations by the riders, and that are in conditions of exploitations that remind us of the very first capitalism formation, a primitive accumulation of capitalism, and which have been also resisted against through specific type of forms of mobilization. And what we see there is also the challenges for a new generations of new technologies. So these extreme forms of exploitation from the mobility stations, especially in services and so on, has been facilitated a lot by Industrial Revolution 4.0. And this we have seen that requires forms of mobilizations that resonate with those of the very first phase of mobilization. I found also interesting there the work by Beverly Silver of the Wallerstein School that present a quite, say, traditional Marxist visions of struggles that move together with capitalism, but which also tried to document the new forms of protest that develop with new forms of exploitation. Which class concepts, asked Marty. What I saw is that in terms of the challenges to be addressed, the work which were to a certain extent important for the 68ers, so these new left visions in which class are not just there to be found, but are to be constructed, is again relevant. And not by chance, I think that Antonio Gramsci became again a very read author in pointing at the importance of the discursive practices in these elements. I gave a lecture, Gramscian lecture last week in Bologna in the Istituto Gramsci, and which is open to non-scholars. And the debate was very interesting because, of course, there was still the ideas that classes could be found there. One of the members of the public told me, yes, but why do you talk about E.P. Thompson? The class is there to be found. So still there are these ideas, but I don't believe that there is a class there to be found. I believe that it is a class to be constructed. And what we found is, as any empirical type of analysis of classes has found, a lot of different groups that live in different tensions that are even bureaucratically fragmented by neoliberalism. If we think about migrants, for instance, there are dozens of different definitions of different types of groups endowed with a different type of rights. And so I think that this work on class consciousness has to be developed. So maybe also there we could go back to Alain Touraine and see how from the study of the labor movements one could develop reflections on ways in which classes are formed. And if I have still 1 minute, maybe also bridging the sociological approaches of scholars like Touraine or Melucci with the political sociology approach of scholars like Stein Rocken that have also attempted to analyze political cleavages not as given, but as constructed through the formations of identities, the so-called normative dimensions of the cleavages, and also by the organizational forms. So the parties that have sort of made a certain type of identification resilient. But Rocken has been looked at especially in terms of explaining stability, while I think that now what we need to do is to explain changes, turning point, momentous moment, intense moment in which what Gramsci called the interregnum, moment in which the old is dying and the new is not born yet.
Okay, thank you. And then a couple of more questions. We have still time, so
just get some water.
One here and one there. So yeah, and please try to be short. Yep, yep. And you have to use this microphone.
Yeah. Does it work?
It's recorded and
okay. Okay. So first of all, I'd like to express my admiration for your interesting lecture. It was. I was impressed by the depth of your analysis. Well, I'm Italian as you are, and And I'd like to mention the Italian situation. There, too, we have a younger generation who is characterized by feeling of precariousness, by loneliness, and but there is also this ground of fear, and which is probably exaggerated by the media, and which is exploited by unscrupulous politicians. No need to mention the names because, and the perspective is really gloomy. In the USA, Sanders managed to channel the anger of the younger generations and their dreams and their wish for a change. And do you think in Italy too, what we need is a prestigious figure who might be able to represent, to give voice to the wish for change and the dreams for change?
Thank you.
Maybe we take another question and then you answer.
Thanks again for a wonderful lecture. I would just like to ask the question on the precariat. Do you think it is a valid category for a viable social movement? You know, when the late Eric Olin Wright was here, I asked the same question, and Professor Eric Olin Wright said that he did not think that it is an identity. You know, it is much better to look at precariat as a description of the condition rather than as a social category. And then bringing back the idea of E.P. Thompson, for instance, when E.P. Thompson asked the question of class formation and class consciousness, he based that on the idea of the historical process and in relational terms. Basically, or in particular, it's the oppressive historical process of capitalism and the unequal relations within capitalism. And also, in addition to the historical process and in relational terms where we define identities, how about in normative terms? Do you still think that precariat itself is an identity? I tend to agree more with the analysis of the late Eric Olin Wright, that it's much better to use precariat as a description of the condition rather than as a category for a viable social movement.
Thank you. Yes, challenging questions, but very interesting, both of them. On Italy, it is true that if we look at the Southern European context, Italy is the gloomiest example, because in Greece, notwithstanding the strong humanitarian crisis, a new party has emerged on the left, which has been criticized also by social movements, but which tended to represent and invent new forms of governing in times of crisis. In Portugal, Portugal became the positive example at the moment with an alliances of the radical left with the left. In Spain, where the perspective were also very gloomy until a few weeks ago, the new elections brought about the opening of possibilities for alliances on the left. In Italy, this didn't happen, and I think comparative analysis should investigate very carefully why it didn't happen in a country that was so much considered as leading in terms of social movements that the first European Social Forum took place in Italy, and Italy was for a long time considered as an example for progressive politics, even though that image has been a bit overstated. But nevertheless, the big questions remain, while then in Italy we end up in what many people consider as a total lack of the left, because the new left is extremely small, divided, and doesn't provide for any sort of alternatives, no Syriza, no Podemos, no Bloque de Izquierda in view. And I think that there the questions should go a step backward and ask ourselves why there was no strong mobilizations in 2011 against austerity, when the Indignados movement were very strong in Spain and in Greece. In Portugal, it was not Indignados occupying the squares, but there were a lot of protests with trade unions and youth organizations converging on same types of claims, while in Italy, the big moment of protest by the progressive forces was in a referendum against the privatizations of water supply that could have sparked a strong mobilizations on the left, because I don't know if, I'm sure you know, but I don't know if many of you know or remember, in 2011, progressive social movements had called for a referendum in Italy against the privatizations of water supply, and this brought about an extraordinary victory. Not only the threshold for validity of the referendums was met with 58% of the voters who went to vote, and it was the first time since a long period, but also about 96% to 98% of the voters expressed their vote against privatizations of water supplies, which meant, in symbolic terms, against privatizations in general. But from that moment, there was no capacity of movements to continue. There was disillusionment because the results of the referendum were not taken seriously. And I think one of the specific problems in Italy was that the groups on the left were splinter groups from the Communist Party of the past, that really were never able to develop significant ties with these young people and young generations. So I think that why there was no strong movements in answering the questions of why there was no strong anti-austerity protest in Italy would contribute to address the questions of why is Italy nowadays one of the most gloomy examples. But you also asked about the potential ways out of it, and talking in terms of leaders, I think that if we look at the countries in which these leaders sort of emerged, are visible, we see that they don't have extraordinary capacities. So it is no Weberian type of charisma of the traditional type. Pablo Iglesias or Tsipras were young leaders that found themselves in a critical moment and were very able to manage transformations. But I think that what was most important was the networks that they were referring to. Sanders and Corbyns are to different extents outsiders from their own parties. Sanders was never a member. Corbyn comes from long-lasting experiences of being in the minority, always the only one who voted against, and so on. So I think that none of the Italian politicians on the left could be a likely candidate to lead a sort of new way, but also that probably the first step would be reconstituting networks, which was the strength of the European Social Forums, but something that did not resist, probably because of the deep trauma of the center-left parties that became less and less center-left, more and more center, and also in comparison with the traditional move towards the third way of the socialist family in Europe, including the SPD in Germany, was a much less socialist party still. So I think that this is one of the characteristics that in Italy explain these special and unexpected positions. And the other question is also interesting. The late Eric Olin Wright was also at the Center on Social Movement Studies to present his ideas on possible utopias. And he came more or less together with Guy Standing. So we could see also, even if they didn't interact together, but we could see this sort of debate at a distance. And, well, what we saw is that precarity is different from proletariat. And in fact, it is also a difference that Guy Standing stresses. Precarity is a condition people want to exit, not a condition that they want to be embedded in. Even though there is also reflections on the fact that the old type of working conditions are not suitable, are not desirable. But we saw the precariat as something more than just a descriptive term, I would say, because a descriptive term is often what is described by the scholars. In this case, there was a sort of reference to precariat to describe a common destiny. And this description of a common destiny is often a first step towards the creation of collective identities. But I think that we still need for a name for it. Because a sort of collective identity is also something that is recognized by the actors who want to propose it through giving it a name. And this is not yet there. I don't think that the new class will call itself as the precariat. Also, I think it is a term which has been used and has been useful in order to single out the common characteristics not only of a generation but also of a time. Because what we saw was that precarity did not affect only young people in precarious position in the labor market, but also in the mobilizations categories that had considered themselves and had been considered as full part of their societies. The working class and the blue-collar workers of factories that were closed down on that or that were forced to accept conditions of labor no longer protected by unions agreements, or retired people that were considered in our welfare state societies as the most protected sectors and instead underwent at the same time cuts in the salaries, in the rents, and decline of the welfare state, so the migrants. So I think that the precariat has been a term that start to be spread, maybe also under the influence of Guy Standing, but also of the reflections in Italy on the left, as a term which is, in fact, used to denominate a common characteristics, but not an identity people would aim at.
Okay, thank you so much. So I believe that we have to move on. So thank you once again.
Thank you.
Now it's time for Maya Fondler to give her
prestige.
Nice day, everyone. Very nice to have you here. Very fascinating texture. I've been working with civic action, but not with the lens of generation in particular, so this is really interesting to hear. So I come from Finnish Environment Institute.
I work in the core project. But here, providing some insights based on our earlier work going from the Ministry of Journalism presentation and then coming to the core project and collaborating with governance. So in our earlier work, we've been interested in how society and civic action has changed because of the digitalization. So I don't discuss the different generations of
that political organization and network organization. This is what we've been looking at as a key point, because earlier you needed the kind of vertical organizations and hierarchies to start things getting done, and now you can just put up a social media group and people can start being active and make things just happen and not waiting for someone to organize it, someone else. And at the same time, there are other related developments. People are not only happy as being consumers, but they are taking more active roles like prosumers. They are not happy that the city is making city plans. Some are active and want to start acting as civic designers and planners by themselves. And they are organizing peer-to-peer marketplaces, for example. And there is the disappointment with the democracies, Donatella discussed. People want more direct action. This is what we have faced here as well. So when someone says activism, it usually brings to your mind something like this, some protests. But also, nowadays, there are many types of activisms that are really proactive and more like let's make things happen now, in the sense. For example, people organize Facebook groups where they provide peer-to-peer support for each other and not waiting for the politicians to do that or organize some framework for doing that. And example from the biodiversity question. In the city of Tampere, Finland, there's an NGO who is not happy with the policy of the city on biodiversity. They are collecting seeds and establishing meadows by their own because the city is not doing that. Something that the city is not used to see citizens do. And if there are very informal ways of civic action, there are also very institutionalized ways, like global networks of very institutionalized NGOs. So there are different types of civic action, and all these make use of the new opportunities by digitalization. But something that is particularly interesting is this network-based action that really puts things happen now and not waiting for someone else to do that. And what we have been found useful is our new concept of the fourth sector. If the third sector is about NGO work, then the fourth sector is something that is not organized mainly by NGOs. It is kind of action that is based on using the opportunities of the internet. It's based on network governing idea, co-creation, and openness of knowledge. So looking at the same picture again, then the fourth circle, it's a type of, if not only about actors, it's a type of action that is especially used by these new network-based activists, but the same action can also be adopted by organizations. There are NGOs that work really in fourth sector type of style, but also entrepreneurs and also public sector actors can adopt characteristics of the fourth sector type of action. In solving complex social problems, the collaboration is very necessary. This is the basic idea in our core project, because nobody has all the necessary knowledge and nobody can make the change and find the solution for these problems alone. So it's necessary to organize things based on the idea of collaborative governance, where people and actors across the across the society, across the spheres of private and public and civic organizations, everyone, all actors are invited to participate in the discussion of how could we solve these problems. And then thinking about the rise of this informal fourth sector type of activism, this challenges the public government, because the ways of the thinking are not yet used to those citizens taking really new, more active roles in the society, and so the practices, because the governments are usually used to think that we reach citizens through NGOs, and this is no more the case necessarily. And these fourth sector type of activist groups, they can be challenging as partners because they don't necessarily seek any partnerships. They are not even oriented to decision-making processes, but they want to make things happen. They are applying their own power and not seeking the same decision-making power that is in the official system. And they have their own rhythms of acting. They can be, Donatella discussed about the rapid action, and this is the opportunity also that arises when something is really acute, there's an acute crisis, then people who are active in social media, they can start organizing something really fast. For example, help for a big masses of refugees. And also it can be challenging to identify these new actors, and it can be difficult to know who to contact with, who to be discussed, because they are networks and there's no necessary any key person. And some opportunities, of course, arise. You can think about energy transformation, for example, when there are many local small initiatives on renewable energy projects, then it brings opportunities for making a wider transformation in the society. And these civic action initiatives, they can be arenas for practicing collaborative skills, and people can develop their rapid action potential. And some examples like citizens making new city plans, they can make use of open data and bring new resources to the society, in that way as well. And these actions, they can supplement other forms of action in the society. And we've been developing the idea of hybrid governing, where there are, you can think about stairs, the relationship between the government and the civil society. You can think about this with these stairs, where in the bottom you have not any contact, you don't even necessarily know who are the civic actors and what they do. And in the top you have a really deeply integrated operation system with them. Your systems, ways of acting are really integrated. So in this idea of hybrid governing, the government identifies fourth sector types of action as a specific group that requires something different from NGOs and seeks ways to align and match the governmental activities with the actions of the citizens and civic groups. And not always are these ways of action collaborative, but collaborative approaches are part of this variety of ways to act. And our idea is that it's really case specific, that what is the appropriate stair, what kind of practice should you apply with each activism. It depends on the case, really. And thinking about collaborative governing, I find it really useful to think of it as a part of the wider frame of hybrid governing, where in some cases collaboration is not the solution, but because all not even want to collaborate, but you have to somehow know what they are and what they do, and to find really choose an informed decision, make an informed decision about how to act with these actors, even if you don't collaborate. So in core project, our key question then is that how to engage a broad range of social actors in the collaborative co-production of wise solutions for contested problems. And here we have many questions related to civil society, especially including these new developments in the digital era. We are working with different cases. We have cases on civic energy, peatlands, land use, wolves. We are making experiments with different collaborative practice methods and approaches like joint fact finding and policy dialogues, citizen juries. And some questions at the moment that we find interesting is to look at how are these different types of civic actions, how do they appear or do they appear in our different cases that we are looking here in Finland, and what are the limits also of collaborative governance approaches from the point of view of different actors. Think about people from different generations as well. Think about our current millennials and also from the elderly. What does this mean when we develop collaborative approaches? And how to support the distribution of benefits from collaborative processes in which some people are involved in developing their own understanding and solutions, then how to think about those who are not involved. And should you restrict some groups being active if someone is really acting proactively to make the society better, then you shouldn't perhaps restrict that when thinking about that people would have different opportunities to be active. You can't have resources to support any all, but if you restrict some without noticing that, it can mean that you lose some resources and opportunities to solve the complex problems. But I will put these slides on the GORE website so that you can also get the references, but I'll stop here so that we have some time for discussion still, but here are our hashtags and website where you can follow it. I hope to see you in the future core events as well. But thank you.
Thank you. And I believe that because it's already 12, 5 minutes past, so we have final words for Donatella. So some reflections what Maija said. So.
Just short word. Just short words, I imagine. Well, I think it's a very interesting project, and I'm proud to be member of the advisory board. There are several concepts parallel to the ones you mentioned of fourth sectors, like direct social actions, that I think could be interesting to put in dialogue with it. And I also think that's about another work I'm doing on democratic innovations, these issues of the relationship between movements and someone in power, institutions, is a very central point. So the movements provide new ideas, but then they need implementation challenge. And I think the work you are doing is wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Outside the classroom because they are.
Yes. Oops.